live from the Valley of the Sun, sharing the news unedited, untainted, and unscreened. The real news you'll never hear on Fox, CNN, or NBC. Serious issues affecting all fellow Americans and the world. The man whose website is monitored by more feds than Osama bin Laden. The man who truly is not ready to make nice. Here's Michael Herzog with The American Awakening.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Friday, April 17th, 2009 edition of The American Awakening. Yes, I'm your host, Michael Herzog, and I will be with you for the next 3 hours. Now, I have to tell you, folks, in my tenure on radio, I've had the privilege of interviewing many educated, dedicated, and patriotic people, authors who have written books exposing corruption, journalists who've taken the initiative to travel to foreign lands and investigate from their own perspective the truth or lies given us by mainstream media, professors, government whistleblowers, pilots, congressmen and women, patriotic Americans from a myriad of professions, all seeking truth. Truth about 9/11, truth about the Iraq invasion, truth about chemtrails, vaccines, pharmaceuticals, torture, and on and on and on. Normally, the most active of the activists walk their journey after seeing or being up close and personal, in one way or another, in the belly of the beast, sometimes more than once. Now, joining us today, we have the extreme privilege of having one of these most active activists visit with us who has indeed seen the belly of the beast up close and personal many times. In fact, every day of his life for several years at one point. You see, he spent better than 4 years in solitary confinement being tortured regularly for a crime he didn't commit. Can you imagine that, folks? For a crime you didn't commit? Torture is bad enough, but a crime you didn't commit. We may just hear that story today. But, you know, something happens within people. When the light of freedom burning within them and all humanity is threatened to be extinguished by brutal, heartless, and tyrannical governments and their cronies, instructed to carry out their cruel brutality. Because if they survive, they grow stronger. And from then on, every act of cruelty or injustice that they witness, perpetrated on any fellow man of any race, creed, or religion by such a tyrannical force, is a fuel that perpetuates their insatiable hunger for freedom and justice. It's the engine that drives all true patriots, folks, some faster and with horsepower than others, yet nonetheless, like a race being run, we all want to cross the finish line free men. Now, folks, on March 17th of this year, this courageous patriot stepped to the forefront and tried to do what our leaders should have done, but have instead waffled, ducked, and dodged their duty, even to the point of becoming criminally complicit in doing so. And what did John Splitting the Sky Boncour attempt to do? He attempted to arrest the war criminal George W. Bush at a speech Bush was giving in Canada. Canada let a war criminal in and arrested a man seeking justice for millions around the world. And with that, folks, it is my extreme privilege to welcome actor, activist, and patriot John Splitting the Sky Boncour to The American Awakening. Welcome, John. Are you with me?
Hey, I'm with you, Michael. Good to be on your show.
Well, as I said, John, it's an extreme privilege to have you up. You're a man after my own heart. You tried to do what millions and millions of people, not only in America, but around the world, would love to see done. John, I have interviewed people, as I said. I don't know whether you're familiar with Susan Lindauer, but they threw Susan Lindauer in prison for 13 months because she could have shut the door on this weapons of mass destruction lie invasion on Iraq, and they wouldn't let her do it. She was a patriot that stood up for the truth. You stood up for the truth, John, and I'd like for you to take some time and share with my listening audience what you tried to do for America and the world.
Okay, basically what it was, Michael, is, as you say, on March the 17th, there was an announcement made on the internet there, and I first read about it by a woman by the name of Gail Davidson, who was the president of a group known as the Lawyers Against War. And in this in this announcement, basically it was saying that George Bush was coming to Canada and was going to be speaking in Calgary, Alberta. And there was a big poster. It said, "Arrest George Bush, war criminal," on the flyer. And so when I was reading this, I said, wow, Jesus is a... Man, this guy, as I read more, it was an invitation to 1,500 oil executive types who are going to go to a place called the TELUS Conference Center in Calgary, Alberta. And then they were going to pay $400 a plate to hear him speak. And I thought to myself, well, first of all, I can't even conceive that this guy has 40 cents worth of knowledge for anyone to listen to about anything, and let alone $400 a plate. I wouldn't pay 40 cents a plate for him, given the fact that this man has totally earned the ire of the whole world for being a reckless murderer and torturer. And that his whole administration basically has taken us down, had taken us down the slippery slope towards all-out tyranny. And I'll get to all of the other background, but right now, having read that particular poster, I said, well, geez, you know, I gotta go to Calgary, and I just can't sit back and let this guy come into Canada and get a $150,000 honorarium, and to speak to all these oil exec types. Basically, these people that are profiteering, because most of the oil executives in southern Alberta are working out of the tar sands. And that land, by the way, is totally contested by the Lubicon Indian Nation, the Lubicon Cree. And they are basically saying that this land has never been surrendered willfully to the Crown, and as such, under the 1763... the 1704 Queen Anne's decision, as well as the 1532 Papal Bull and other case law that has yet to be settled surrounding the whole question of title of unceded Indian land. Of course, the Cree have contested the pipeline that's running from British Columbia into the tar sands of southern Alberta through the Terracing gas line. And Terracing, by the way, is a company that is owned by a Texas firm. And they're extrapolating my hydro bill right out of here on a monthly basis. Outrageous hydro bills. Okay, so then I find out that the people that were sponsoring it was the Chamber of Commerce. And there were two fellas, two entrepreneurs, business entrepreneurs, that were basically make this their hustle. They get names. They brought in... Before, they brought Bill Clinton in, they brought Hillary in, they brought in a bunch of other people from previous administrations. And what they do is they get all of these executives, predominantly in Calgary, because, again, the Alberta tar sands, the oil that is produced out of Alberta, there's more oil produced out of Alberta on unsurrendered Indian land that is and sent to the United States than there is from Saudi Arabia to the United States. That's how much oil we're exporting from here to there illegally. And a good 50 to 60% of the people living in Calgary are basically transplants from Texas, which is why they call this particular province, that particular town in Alberta, Elbert Texans, right, or Texas North. And so the point was, having already known that history, but then seeing that the these two fellows that bring in these well-known political figures, bring them in for $150 $150,000 a head, or, you know, for their honorarium. But of course, they double and triple their money after they sell out seats to all these oil execs in their interest in the oil industry. So, there was also a company by the name of Bennett Jones that brought them in. And Bennett Jones is known to be the lawyers for the Husky Oil Company up here, which is one of the largest, along with Petro-Canada, and as well as representing Terracing Gas. So, and then also Ernest and Young, right, which really facilitates a lot of business transactions in the oil industry worldwide. They're known for this worldwide. So having looked at that, I says, well, you know what? More than anything else, I could never, ever stop in my life. I can never forget the searing images of the kind of tortures that have been conducted by the Bush administration.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll tell you what, John, let me stop you there. We got to take our first break here. It's a 3-minute break. When we get back, we'll expound on this a little bit further. Folks, you don't want to miss 1 minute of this, because when we get back, we're going to go into a lot of detail about John's arrest. We're going to go into it about torture. We're going to go into it about what's going on. Hopefully, we're going to get into some other issues with John, too. And I'm going to tell you exactly who he is when we get back. So stick with us back in 3. Folks, we're back with the American Awakening. My special guest, John Splitting the Sky Boncour. Before I get back to my guest, folks, in case you don't know, I got to tell you who John Boncour is. All right, this guy has had movies made about him. I believe it was Morgan Freeman that played him in the movie Attica, because John Boncour was in Attica. He was put in prison for a crime that he did not commit. He was accused of killing a prison guard, which he did not do, and spent 4 years, I believe, in solitary confinement and was tortured on a regular basis. Am I right in that, John? It was over 4 years?
Well, not quite 4 years, about 3 years.
Okay, 3 years. All right, well, we're going to cover that today, but before we do that, let's get back to your story here about these oil executives being paid $400 a plate to go speak, or let this fool that knows nothing, that can't string a sentence together, speak to these guys. So go ahead.
Yeah, so anyways, I guess each and every one of your listeners, we all seen those searing images of, you know, of prisoners being, you know, with electric prods on them, dangling with hoods over them, hooded, partially naked, fully naked, piled onto each other, and, dogs barking, sexual attacks. We heard about women taking their menstrual periods and wiping it on the face of these Muslim men. We heard about the waterboarding that went down. We heard about stress positions and put on a rotation basis. And we've seen these images coming out of Abu Ghraib that was leaked by some of the lower level torturers. And at the same time, we also knew and had heard about the torture memos that came out of Albert Gonzalez's office as Attorney General under Bush. He and Assistant Attorney General then Jay Baby, who's now a federal judge who supports torture, along with now we see others that were included in the current list by the Spanish prosecutor, who was the former Baldassar Cordon, or Cordon Baldassar, was calling for the prosecution of 6 administrators in the Bush administration, including David Addison from Cheney's department, and Antonio Gonzalez, and Douglas Fife, and a few others.
William Haynes.
William Haynes, right. And so now, knowing that these guys, I remember hearing during that whole time, I remember hearing one of the statements that was made by John Woo, who I believe was he was the attorney for the Justice Department. He's the one that wrote the torture memos. Now, I remember hearing him on a talk show somewhere saying that if they had to arrest somebody from one of the, if they got somebody as young as 12 years old and suspected them of having information that could lead to terrorists held out in various al-Qaeda cells, then if that 12-year-old refused to talk, and if they were to take a spike and run it through the 12-year-old's testicles to extrapolate information, that as far as they were concerned, as long as they didn't basically kill his ability to reproduce, but just to scare him into a confession that it would be acceptable and that it wasn't against the conventions of Geneva of 1906 or the UN Charter against the use of torture in warfare. Now, I'll get into it a bit later here, but all of my research, and I will, when I talk about 9/11, all of my research showed me that 9/11 was a bogus war, not only because they were promulgating the international lie that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. We heard that there was at least 935 major accusations made, major accounts in the international media of WMDs coming out of Iraq. But in reality, we know that Iraq was the Bush-Cheney administration's guaranteeing of the big oil cartels of the world, and predominantly the Rockefeller and Rothschild families, guaranteeing them that they would in fact invade and seize control of the second largest deposits oil field in the world, and that was in Iraq. Of course, they did it with Ahmed Shalabi and other peoples that collaborated with them in order to effect this move. And then the next thing you know, we see bombs dropping all over Iraq. We see the illegal invasion and occupation of Iraq. We see that it was predicated on lies told predominantly and sold, bought and sold for by Colin Powell at the United Nations level to get a coalition of the so-called willing to come together around the world and invade Iraq because, well, even Iraq even had ties with Al-Qaeda, which we know was another lie. So having seen the thousands and thousands of bombs through night vision goggles at nighttime, bombing the hell out of Baghdad, and just hearing about the kind of abductions of suspected Al-Qaeda operatives, then we heard stories that these Blackwater-type mercenaries who went into Iraq and Afghanistan just seized Iraqi men from the ages of 10, 11 to 60, 65 years old. They seized them, they beat them, they hooded them, they disrobed them, and they put them into trucks and just seized them up if they didn't get killed in the process for some level of resistance, just outrightly shot to death. We heard stories, horror stories, about Iraqi women and Afghani women being raped in front of their husbands to get confessions out of them on the spot, to be raped their daughters in front of them, or their sons to be molested. So these were the horror stories we heard. Now, these were illegal abductions and eventually assassinations. But we heard that when they went to Abu Ghraib, and then when they went to Bagram, and eventually to Guantanamo Bay, we heard about all these terrible forms of torture. I read about these tortures. I read about the continual dehumanizing degradation that was going on against the Iraqi people and the Afghani peoples in this bogus war on terror. And, of course, I saw the unbridled, the unstoppable war on terror that was predicated on a false flag operation they conducted on 9/11 in New York City. And I can tell a whole story on that. And by the way, just a recent report now says that the ex-Italian president, I forget his name, Consigliere or something like that, the ex-president of Italy now has come out and said basically point blank that 9/11 was a Mossad CIA operation. Of course, I said that from day one, mm-hmm. But we'll get back to that. Okay. Now, so knowing that this 9/11 was an inside job and that the justification, the incursion into Iraq and Afghanistan was a justification for the oil from Iraq, and then as well to seize control of the pipelines from the Caspian Sea, from Azerbaijan, the Baku, Tbilisi, Sayan pipelines to BTC.
Yeah. All right, the music's coming up. You're learning quick there, John. We got to take a break. We'll get back and talk more about these pipelines in Iraq and the seizure of the second largest oil in the world of Iraq and the lies that we're told with John splitting this guy, Boncor. Stick around. Call your friends and neighbors, folks. This is going to be a barn burner here. Be back in three. Folks, we're back with the American Awakening. My special guest, John Splitting the Sky, Boncor. And before I get back to my guest, I want to put out his website. It's splittingthesky.net. Again, that's splittingthesky.net. And also, you might want to go to warcriminalsout.com. That's warcriminalsout.com. And I had gone into splittingthesky.net this morning, and there's just a myriad of valuable information there, folks. There's hours worth of watching and formal education you can get on a number of different issues because of John Splitting the Sky, Boncor. And, John, I'm going to get back to you on your story here, but I wanted to touch base because this could just cross my desk here just this morning. You were talking about the torture and some of the things that they had done, and, John, you condoning this torture. Well, now the Bush memos parallel a claim that the mastermind's children, the mastermind, they're claiming the mastermind to be Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, which is a farce, but mm-hmm. they tortured his son, and they used insects on him.
Yeah,
ants and other creatures put it on his legs. They locked him in a little box where he couldn't sit up and he couldn't lay down or anything, and then they would put insects on him and let him bite him, and they turned loose mosquitoes in that little cage. This is just absolutely horrendous, John. Go ahead. Yeah. Continue.
Well, that just goes to show you the kind of insanity that we've allowed these torture murders. It's just all-out insanity that these people were able to I don't know. I guess they got a free ticket out of hell for about 8 years. But when you think about it, getting back to, you know, the sort of the things that in my the back of my mind about those that are responsible behind the invasion into Iraq and the torture. You know, I have to inject here this moment. In today's posting, or the last couple of days posting in the www.afterdowningstreet.com or .org, there's a little article written by, or just a little note written by a guy by the name of Robert Terceni, and he says, and the title of it is AIG Liable for Lack of Iraqi Construction. And it says, I've run across several things focusing on the relationship between AIG and the Iraq and Afghan occupations. AIG insures over 80%, that's over 80% of the non-military, military contractors in Iraq, i.e. KBR, and if you don't know what that is, that's Kellogg, Brown, and Root, Blackwater, Halliburton, New York Times article 2007. Since well over 1,200 contractors have been killed and thousands more wounded, with all the other liabilities going on over there, if AIG is insolvent, what's going to happen with all the claims? Clearly, AIG drank its own Kool-Aid, believing that the occupation was going to be a cakewalk. They never imagined the scope of the liabilities. It's striking that AIG has underwritten all of the construction in Iraq as well. If virtually none of the public infrastructure is functional, AIG is essentially liable for every dollar that has been spent. And then they post a link there to the PDF about AIG documents. Now, but here's something else that I ran across in my research about AIG. First of all, at some point when I talk about 9/11 and I come back to that, I'm going to talk about AIG, right? Who was owned and controlled by Maurice Hank Greenberg, as well as another corporation called Marsha McLuhan, which was owned, and who the chief CEO was his son, Jeffrey Greenberg. And the Greenbergs' affiliation to the Bush family, or the Bush syndicate, I like to call them. But the point that I had run across, I found out almost a year ago that, while we're on the topic of torture, that of the of all of the CIA's extraordinary renditions when they abducted suspected terrorists, both in America, abducted them and deported suspected terrorist sympathizers, and deported mostly Muslim or people of color to the so-called torture-friendly countries like Syria, Egypt, Israel, and the like, to conduct torture on them, to extrapolate information. And that as well as all of those that were abducted in Iraq and Afghanistan and other parts of the world. But what a lot of what I found out about Maurice Hank Greenberg was, is that he personally loaned and rented out 400, that's 400 of his own airplanes to the CIA for these extraordinary renditions to these black sites internationally. Now, you and I both know, and your listening audience know, that AIG is right at the hub of the current scandal relative to the bailouts being conducted by the Bush and now the Osama administrations.
Mm-hmm.
But what a lot of people also don't know is that AIG was one of the major recipients of billions of dollars in put option stock trading prior to 9/11 on Wall Street, meaning that AIG, Maurice Hank Greenberg, along with Henry Kissinger, who, by the way, was spearheading the drive for the pipelines in Afghanistan to Pakistan, that whole pipeline from Afghanistan to Pakistan, he was negotiating that at both ends. And subsequently, he, with Maurice Greenberg and another person by the name of Pete Peterson, of an insurance umbrella company called Blackstone. Blackstone was the organization that financed, with Larry Silverstein, they financed $111 million to Larry Silverstein's $14 million for two white elephants known as laced with asbestos and with hardly any clientele in the buildings known as the Twin Towers. Now, we're talking about the dots and the connections, and what we are basically seeing here is that AIG, Henry Kissinger, George Soros, and the Rockefellers were totally behind bringing the Twin Towers down and benefiting from it. Marshall McMillan was one of the recipients of the put option stocks, and you have to understand that the two major insurance companies in this whole situation, including Blackstone, after 9/11, with the state of paranoia, with the Patriot Act and the complete suppression of civil liberties and the pandemonium that was caused worldwide about possible boogeyman terrorists, Al-Qaeda cells and assassins, what basically happened was is that AIG, as well as Berkshire Hathaway's, owned by Warren Buffett, which was another beneficiary of the stocks, put option stocks, 9/11, all benefited billions of dollars, knowing those towers were going down because they knew that, both the CIA and the Mossad, and I also included, members of the SAS as well as the ISS of Pakistan, SAS of Great Britain, were involved in planting explosives in them buildings and bringing it down. Now, if this don't get me labeled as a terrorist by the head of Homeland Security, Miss, what's her name there?
Napolitano.
What's her first name?
Janet
Napolitano. Because as you told me there earlier, that she's saying anybody that doesn't go with the official story can be labeled a terrorist and prosecuted.
Well, not can be, is. He's either a conspiracy theorist, an extremist, and possibly a terrorist. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but there were about 38 corporations involved in these put options, and the 9/11 Commission came out and said it's of no consequence, which is totally absurd.
Absolutely no consequence. And that's, I mean, that was a whitewash commission. There's no doubt about it. And is it ironic that one of the key figures behind 9/11, bringing those towers down, those white elephants, in order to justify an incursion into the Mideast, was none other than Henry Kissinger, the guy that they were going to appoint to oversee the commission from day one, along with Maurice Hayne Greenberg.
And the only reason he wasn't...
See, I have to say at this point right now, there was enough evidence because the major evidence I'm speaking about relative to the insurance scandals that went down was put forward to us by a fellow by the name of Richard Andrew Grove. Have you interviewed him on your show?
No, but I've heard his testimony.
Okay, his testimony basically says that he was working for McMillan, Marshall McMillan, and that...
Mm-hmm. That's all right. All right. We'll get back to Richard Grove and Marshall McLellan when we get back in three. My special guest, I just flipped his switch and I've warmed him up here, folks. John, Splitting the Sky, Bond Corps. We'll be back in three. Much, much more to come. And believe it or not, eventually he's going to tell us about his arrest. So stick around. Be back. We're back with the American Awakening. My special guest, John, Splitting the Sky, Bond Corps. And it's interesting. I was talking to John during the break, and earlier when I was introducing him, I was talking about a race. You know, we all wanted to finish the race, and I tell you, John's a race car because you get him going, it's hard to turn him off. Anyway, back to John. John, continue with your story.
Okay,
so we've got Richard Grove.
Anyways, so what we got there, anyways, with Richard Andrew Grove, is you got him telling his story of how he had created the software, Proma software, that allowed Berkshire Hathaway and most predominantly AIG, along with Marsh and McMillan, right, which are two prominent people that were on the of the 38 corporations that benefited from the put option stock treaties on Wall Street prior to 9/11. But basically what he said was, is that when he had exposed this, he was getting all these perks and commissions, man, for all the millions and millions of dollars to the tune of billions that they were transferring to independent bank accounts in Israel and around the world, the Cayman Islands and Swiss accounts, that all this money that they were sending out on behalf of the Greenberg family connected directly to Greenberg Traurig, which was the lawyers that represented Bush when he stole the elections in 2000 from Al Gore. So having known that, basically what he said is that they had fired him, and then on the morning of 9/11, they had called him back in for a conference call on the 98th floor of the North Tower, and when they called him in, if he got stuck in traffic and was a half hour late, and had he been up there in the room when the plane hit the 98th floor, it's the building, over 300 of his co-workers were murdered that day, and he was scheduled to be murdered. So all this I'm saying in a nutshell to say that there's enough evidence out there right now to call on Andrew Young but Andrew Cuomo in New York State, who is doing all of these other side investigations of AIG's illegal giving out of bonuses, man, to all the people from AIG and so on and so forth. But the fact of the matter is there is enough information out here to show that this was a contrived inside job, and that certainly Greenberg, with the Bush family, should definitely be investigating, along with Cheney and others, many others, for plotting to bring him down to those towers. Now, those aren't blind allegations. But in any event, getting back to what happened on March the 17th, when I had seen that they were going to have this rally, I had talked with some people who put up a few bucks to help me to organize, to bring a bunch of people over that way, and to protest Bush's visit. Now, I had contacted Gail Davidson from the Lawyers Against War, and I also contacted Ramsey Clark, the former U.S. Attorney General of the United States. He was the one of my lawyers, one of my main lawyers, to getting me free from my days of being in Attica State Prison in New York as a result of the 1971 Attica Rebellion, which we'll talk about a little later here. But what happened basically was that I had read a position that was put out by the Lawyers Against War, and basically there was a letter written by Gail Davidson to the head of the RCMP, the commissioner in Ottawa here, in Canada, and basically stating that according to the Canadian criminal law, that if George Bush were to come into this country, first of all, he should be banned from coming into this country for being a self-admitted torturer.
Mm-hmm.
Ian Cheney admitted to...
right, they admitted on mainstream TV.
And advocating that it should be, and that they basically were bypassing during the time of the war on terror, in the climate of the war on terror, that many of the safeguards relative to the treatment of prisoners will be suspended by the Bush administration in violation of the Geneva Conventions and the UN charters on torture. So basically what happened was that she said to him, a guy by the name of Shablas, I think his name is Raymond or Ron Shablas, of the RCMP in Ottawa, and told them that he should be banned from coming into the country to do this talk, but if he does come to the country to do that talk, that he should be arrested. Well, then Shablas wrote back a couple of days later and basically said, look, based on what you have said, it will not be the position of the RCMP to arrest this man, a former head of state in the U.S., and even as a civilian, because he doesn't reside here permanently, so he's just kind of like allowed in and allowed out. Well, that was a bunch of BS. That eventually would infuriate me, but it infuriated me to think that this guy even had the audacity to come in and test the waters, as he said. He himself said he was going to test the waters to see how he would be received worldwide as a public speaker. And I make a little joke. I said, I guess he didn't realize he was going to run up against a Mohawk Cree a tsunami. And in that case, that'd be me. So anyway, what happened then is that I packed up a bag and I headed out, man, and it was organizing with some people locally from the anti-war movement there, peace and justice activists. And we got together with a fellow by the name of Tavis Ford, who was one of the coordinators there. And so we got together, and I stayed there with him, and we organized. We were sending out invitations to people all over to come and to protest Bush's presence here. Well, by the time the morning of the 17th came, there was amassed about 700 people came at that point to be at this gathering. I mean, people were coming left and right, so it was a highly spirited demonstration building. And then, but at the same time, there were hundreds and hundreds of Calgary police. I believe the RCMP was there. There was certainly Secret Service all over around Bush. And there were actually a number of people on the rooftops with sniper rifles and goggles and infrared scopes, checking out the scene, pointing their guns in our direction, and letting us know that they were there. But they were Blackwater type, independent security there. So I went up to the line, and I had talked with a guy, a fellow by the name of Nathan, who was a filmmaker, and I basically said to him, I said, look, I want you to constantly document what I'm doing here, because I don't want, even though there was a lot of major media there, I have found for the most part that the media basically in Canada is complicit with the RCMP. And as a matter of fact, a lot of the tapes that they had did in my experience at Gustavson Lake in 1995, in a standoff we had here with the RCMP, we found that the TV station CTV was basically a front for the RCMP, and that they were taking all this documented interviews and film and stuff, and they were taking it to the special, the operations commanders, and the stuff never made the air except for what the operations commanders wanted to post as one-sided disinformation, really. So I made sure that this young fellow here, a young brother from the Calgary 9/11, basically was there at full time, you know, to document. So he documents me going up to them with a bag of papers that basically had the law from the Lawyers Against the War, as well as a solidarity statement, which I'll read to you a little later, that was sent by my lawyer, Ramsey Clark, at my request for this demonstration. So now, after telling the RCMP, and you can go, you can, when you, if you Google, Splitting the Sky, Arrest Bush, you, as well as you go to, splittingthesky.net and warcriminalsout.com, you'll see all the film of what actually happened at that point. What I did basically was that I informed the RCMP twice that this man, according to Canadian Criminal Code, was a war criminal, and that he shouldn't be allowed into this country. But since he's here, he should be arrested. And the RCMP, or the Calgary police, looked at me while they were in lines with their mountain bikes, and they looked at me like I was crazy. And so and they were laughing at me. Some of them, and the other ones were just telling me to get the F out of their face. So I told them, I said, look, I said, that's two warnings I give you. On the third warning I come, I'm going to break this line. And I'm going to arrest him myself, because I'm sick and tired of a war criminal being treated like royalty. I said, this guy is a mass murderer, and he's also a mass torturer. This guy is completely psychologically deranged with the rest of the administration, man, that was and the neoconservatives in his administration. And every one of them has to be held accountable for war crimes. And I said, I am not hardly playing here, so if I come, the third time I come, be ready for me to break this line. Well, when I came and I asked them, I said, are you going to arrest him? They said, no, I made my move and I broke the line. I broke the line and I went through about maybe 10 steps.
All right, wait a minute, John. Tell you what, you timed that just right, okay? You warned him twice. You broke the line. We've got to take a break and go to the news, folks. You don't want to go anywhere. Don't change that dial, okay? John's going to tell us what happened when he broke the line when we get back after the news. Perfect timing, John. See you after the news, folks. Much more to come. We're going to get into some more stuff about 9/11, and we're going to get into some stuff about Attica. Many, many movies made about this, and this guy is the reason why. See you after the news.
Forget. Sounds good. Forget. I'm not sure I could. They say time heals everything, but I'm still waiting.
Live from the Valley of the Sun, sharing the news unedited, untainted, and unscreened. The real news you'll never hear on Fox, CNN, or NBC. Serious issues affecting all fellow Americans and the world. The man whose website is monitored by more feds than Osama bin Laden. The man who truly is not ready to make nice. Here's Michael Herzog with The American Awakening.
Folks, we're back. Second hour of the American Awakening with my special guest, John Splitting the Sky Boncour. And before the break, we were talking about the RCMP. John had warned them twice that if they didn't arrest George Bush, that he was going to break the line and do it. So, John, you broke the line. What happened?
Okay, so after I break the line, I get about maybe five steps towards the door. And he, of course, was on the next floor, and you gotta figure there was probably a gauntlet of Secret Service all the way up there on the inside, and as well as regular RCMP. But the thing about it was, is at that moment, I mean, I was just led by something just came over me. It was a spiritual thing that just came over me and says, "Hey, you know, we can either talk the talk and walk the walk, or we just don't," you know. And my belief is that they have to be arrested, and if the RCMP was derelict in their duty, I believe, according to a legal clause called mens rea, in any case, that I had the right, my intent was to arrest a war criminal. So as I got about five steps into it, they grabbed me and they body slammed me. They knocked my face right into the concrete, which I still have partial numbness today. Not as bad as clearing up, but for a while there, it was pretty numb on the right side of my face. My glasses were broke. I had to get those fixed. Then they're not completely fixed right now. So they handcuffed me. Now, you can see if you look at our websites that I previously mentioned, splitintosky.net and or warcriminalsout.com, and you'll see, the actual footage, or if you go to YouTube, Nathan Moulton Films, you'll see, the actual arrest, what happened. But you'll see that when I was trying to arrest Bush, you can hear one cop yell, "He hit a cop! He hit a cop!" Well, he hit me, right? And then you'll hear me say, "I never touched you. I never touched you." Because I knew that that was the cue. Well, if you hit him, you assaulted him, somebody's got the right to pull out a taser and taser me to death or shoot me and kill me.
Mm-hmm.
So my voice does carry. And fortunately, I was able to talk above the crowd. But there was hundreds of media there, too, at least 100 different media. And at least they got that part. So then what happens, I said, "I never hit you." I caught my breath, and then I just kind of toned it down a second there, and I looked around, and then I started chanting to the crowd while I was still locked into that circle of all the cops, being circled by at least 50 cops around me. I then said, handcuffed with my wrist swelling, I says, "Well, arrest Bush, not me. Arrest Bush, not me." And so the crowd started yelling, "Arrest Bush, arrest Bush." Then I started saying, as I was walking towards the paddy wagon, "Arrest Bush, arrest Bush, arrest Bush." Now, if you see, when you look at that and you see me standing and still saying "arrest Bush" with my face towards the back of the paddy wagon before they put me in there, they open up the door, and you'll see the door closing in right on my head when he turns around. He lets the door in, and it smashes me right on my head. That hurts still today. But in any event, I'm not crying over the lumps you got to take. And when you make a move like that, you got to expect whatever comes. Whatever lumps come your way, you take it. That's because you don't do it, you don't cry about it later. You take what comes at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't cry about it. You make your move. As you deal with it, however it comes, whatever it brings, you go with it. And that's just the way the path of the warrior. You have to do it, and the peace warrior is you have to do it. And this was a nonviolent, peaceful resistance act. It was done in accordance with an act that was laid out, a definition of the act, which I'm going to give you a little definition here a little later, that was put out by Professor Francis Boyle. In his book, The Power of Politics, which basically deals with a section called The Right of the People to Civil Resistance, meaning the people have the right to arrest as civilians suspected war criminals in the absence of the regional police authorities being derelict in their duties. So predicated on that, which was really the basis of a lot of the beliefs of the Lawyers Against War, a peaceful, non-violent organization that calls for the arrest of war criminals like Bush. And so coupled with that, all that information, I believe I had mens rea, the right of intent to arrest this guy. Well, once they get me into that long ride over to the Calgary Police Station, I get there, they book me. But while I'm handcuffed, I tell them to get these goddamn things off me. Excuse my language.
Gosh darn. Go ahead.
Yeah. So anyways, so I told them I'd get these goddamn things off of me, and they told me to go F myself, and I said, "You know, well, you go F yourself." And we went back there, and the guy come over and gave me a knee to my groin. Drops me, and then I still have some pain there today. But, of course, like everything else, everything heals in due time. So, given that circumstances there, I was arrested and initially charged with assault and obstruction. Now, what happened then later was, is that they dropped the assault charges because you look at the video, all the video, and of course, again, the young fellow man that I said, Nathan, to stay with me, he did a meticulous job to show what really happened there. So they couldn't let that it would never stick in a court of law. They couldn't make that stick. So they dropped it down to obstruction, which is a lesser charge. But I say, hey, wait a minute. I'm not guilty of any charge because I believe I instructed the police to arrest a war criminal, and they obstructed me from doing my job as a civilian to arrest them, arrest Bush in the absence of them being derelict. And all they basically did was provided security for the rich and the powerful. So being in jail... Now, they have this thing, when you go inside jail, or up here anyways, that you're supposed to see a justice of the peace within 24 hours. It's mandatory law. Now, if you go before a justice of the peace, you can ask for bail to be released in your own recognizance. But then I was advised by a lawyer, because Ramsey Clark had called there twice. Gail Davidson from the Lawyers Against War called there a bunch of times. My wife and was in contact with some people that were holding the vigil downstairs all night long, and they had actually told the one guy who's a professor, Tony Ho, who wrote an excellent article prior to this at my request for him to write this article about the Bush League. It's called Bush League, Anthony Ho. You'll find that on the website there, warcriminalsout.com. But then, so Tony, man, had called my wife and said that they told him that they had released me. Well, of course, they didn't release me. And so my wife told him, no, if he'd have been released, he would have called home. He never called home. So she told him to stay there. And those people, the other people that was with him, and they stayed there all night long, which was good because in this way they realized that they just couldn't get away with a Billy Jack type, a move. I don't know if your people ever, your listeners ever saw the Billy Jack movies, but it'd be good to look at those. In any event, what happened was then here's how I should have been about the seventh or eighth person. And maybe somewhere around, because the justice of the peace go all night long, 24 hours. I should have been about 7th or 8th in line to go and see this JP. But what they did is they let everybody, 20, 30 people came in after me to see the JP, and they left me for the last half hour before I was supposed to see the JP. Now, the lawyer that I contacted locally there, he told me that what I should do is ask the Calgary cop, before you go into this little kangaroo court and see the justice of the peace, through a teleconference, and this was a madam justice, I don't remember her name, but in any event, this is ask the cop if he is opposed to your release. If he's opposed to your release, don't go in and request bail. Wait till the regular bail hearings to be arraigned in court.
Okay. All right, well, we got to take a break. We'll be back in 3 minutes. We'll continue with this story with my special guest, John Splitting the Sky Boncour. Stick around, folks. Much more to come. Back after the break.
Coming down the sunny day.
About ready to see a magistrate, and they put him in the back of the line, sort of like Arlo Guthrie's, they all moved away from me on the Group W bench. So go ahead and continue with your story, John.
Yeah, so basically what happened then was, hello?
Hello?
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, basically what happened was that I went before the Justice of the Peace, And like again, she was like a teleconference on like a big flat screen, and he was reading the charges. Now he started bringing up
things from my past, being in Attica, and another assault, a fight I had in the village in New York, which was thrown out in court, which Ramsey Clark represented me on. But he started bringing that up. I said, whoa, wait a minute, hold on, stop right there. I said, first of all, that stuff was done when I was a juvenile. I was accused of this stuff when I was under 18 years old. It's under my juvenile records, and now juvenile records are to be closed permanently. And then the judge says, yes, officer, does he have any arrest in Canada here? And he said, no, he has absolutely no arrest at all. So then she heard it, and she says, well, I says, I would like bail. Be released from my own recognizance. She said, well, I'm sorry, sir, but because you are from British Columbia and you're in Alberta right now, she says, I have to at least ask for a $500 retainer. So one of the fellas, the local organizers of the anti-Bush demonstration, put up the $500 for me. And then I was scheduled to go on March 25th for a hearing. I went for the first hearing to enter a plea. But at this point, there was a number of lawyers that were trying to be, you know, to be my lawyer because of the exposure. But I wasn't right. satisfied with where, when I ran, questions to them about what they saw politically. they didn't want to deal with the politics of the situation, so I just basically excused them and just went on. I just had one guy go in there and try to put it over till April the 16th. That was yesterday. In the interim, I did, contact the guy by the name of Charles Davison out of Edmonton, which is a couple hour drive to Calgary. And, he is affiliated with Gail, Davidson from the Lawyers Against War. And, he and I are basically on the same page. And so, a couple of days ago, I signed papers bringing him on as my lawyer, and then he got the date set back to enter a plea for April 29th, and then that's when I'm supposed to go back to court. Now, he is going to try to argue that we should put it over for trial and try to have a 3 to 4 day trial, which he states to me in a memo that he doesn't think that the trial lawyer or judge is going to like that at all. Crown is going to push for about a two to three hour type deal to say that, hey, he bullied his way through, he obstructed a peace officer, and subsequently he should be fined. And or, because it's been reduced to a summary indictment, basically it's a trial by judge. If it was an indictment, if it was an all-out indictment, it would be, I would have the right to a jury. But I still have the right to present evidence. I would call in Ramsey Clark and Gail Davidson and Professor Tony Hall and others as my witnesses. But they're going to argue they don't want the big case. As a matter of fact, I believe, as we discussed during the break there, that more than likely they're going to probably push the state of charges. But that doesn't mean anything to me. I mean, I still face, as it is right now, a fine to 2 years in prison. Mm-hmm. And I almost took a bullet, and I almost got tasered to death for doing so because of my belief, and only my belief. I mean, at this point, I came to one of those really weird junctures in every one of our lives where we're put to the critical test. When we talk to ourselves and we look at ourselves and we say, "Hey, you, do you really believe in what you say you believe in?" And when you ask yourself that question, well, if you believe in arresting Bush, that he needs to be arrested, and you know that they're not going to arrest him because the cops protect the rich and the powerful, they really don't protect the grassroots element anymore, the people. They protect the special interests. They protect, the power class. And so at that point, you have to say, well, the government and the police establishment are supposed to be working for we, the people. But in light of the fact that they no longer recognize, and since post 9/11, it looks like the Constitution has been eradicated. The basic constitutional rights have fallen apart left and right. The right to habeas corpus in legal proceedings is basically out the door during the Bush administrations. The right to keep military out of the streets under posse comitatus has been thrown out the back door. We've got Patriot Acts number 1 and 2 subsequent to 9/11 suppressing the civil rights of human beings. and our constitutional rights and Bill of Rights and Charter of Rights in Canada here. So all of this is creeping fascism, and we've entered nothing more, nothing less than an all-out police state in the U.S., as well as the creeping police state in Canada here. And so I, for one, do not want to wait around until they can legitimately seize my little 12-year-old boy and run a spike through his testicles to extrapolate information on what to the, what their old man is up to.
Which, if things go like they're going, John, could very well happen. Now, you know, we're looking at, well, I'm looking at a number of articles here regarding this issue, and we go back to square one. First, folks, I want to pose this to you in the audience now. Okay, John made a very good point. When, you know, there comes a time when you have to examine yourself and say, well, you, do you really believe what you believe? Because you know if you step into that lion's pit like John did, you may just get your hind end busted. You may get tasered. You may get shot. You may get thrown into prison or whatever. And it comes a point in time where you've got to have the guts and the fortitude, and you have to believe it 100%. And that is the defining moment, John.
Yes.
And what we're talking about here, the step that you made, okay, is a step that millions of people out there want done, but the question that comes to mind is, do you folks in the listening audience, do you have the guts? Have you looked inside yourself and asked yourself, have you got the guts to do something like that? Because, and I want to expound on this a little bit, John, you know, and we've talked about this both on and off the air, is that ultimately they will wind up, just like they did with Susan Lindauer, they will drop the charges because they do not want to have all of the publicity on this. They do not, I mean, you've got such a valid argument. You have the law on your side, and they know it. So
right.
they cannot afford to you know, try to make a big mountain out of this, because if they do, it could come back to bite them, and they know that as well. So,
exactly.
Yeah, the bottom line is that you made a statement. You've made a statement for the sake of millions of people in this country, in your country, and around the world, that the people are sick of this. Now, we saw on the 15th, just 2 days ago, we saw tax protests going on all over this country to the tune of millions of people. People are getting sick to death of what the elites are doing to us, and the elites are scared. And henceforth, John, the reason why that these memos are starting to come out, these directives are coming out of Homeland Security by your friend Janet Napolitano, that is declaring all of us, everybody that has that belief, anybody who does not goose step and lockstep with the government, they are now trying to deem a terrorist. It's come full circle, John. You remember,
yes.
You know, originally it was 19 Muslim hijackers.
Yes.
Now it's the American people, it's the Canadian people, it's anybody who does not agree with anything, including but not limited to abortion, property rights, real ID, RFID chips, you put a bumper sticker on your car that they don't like, you put what they consider a subversive movie in the back of the seat of your car, and they're going to harass you, they're going to arrest you, they're going to taser you. And this is what people like you are standing up and doing something about this, folks. And this is why I can't emphasize enough. You need to look down deep and find out, do you have the guts to do what John Splitting the Sky Boncour has done? Think about that. We'll be back after the break with more. Michael Herzog, The American Awakening. Stick with us until after the break. We got much more to come. Alright, folks, we're back with The American Awakening and John Smith Sky Boncour. John, go ahead and continue. You were going to talk a little bit about civil resistance. Go ahead.
Yes. So basically, what I was basically confronted with was this: is I believe, being a Mohawk Cree native, but some of my roots is based in the Six Nations Iroquois Confederacy, and I come from the Confederacy that basically upholds what we call the Dayanagoa, which is the Great Law. Now, the Great Law was brought to us in the 13th century by a prophet by the name of Daganoweda. He was a prophet and a political statesman and a great visionary. Now, Daganoweda brought us the Guyanagoa, which was later adopted by the founding fathers of the American Revolution as the structure for a democratic process. Out of the great law, the Guyanagoa, came the concept of the two-thirds majority vote, which is used at the General Assembly level. The whole concept of the people's referendum to hold public servants accountable for their deeds, for recall, came from the great law. Women's equality was totally recognized in the matriarchal society. The clan mother held power to impose the elected officials and depose them by way of the war chief if they were erring, if they had become corrupt and deceitful. The whole question of national, the right to national self-defense, the Second Amendment of the Constitution came from the great law. The whole procedures of the Haudenosaunee or the Longhouse, the structure was the structure that was adopted by the congressional bodies of both the House and the Speaker came from the Longhouse, the Guyanagoa, the Great Law, as well as the Parliamentary Proceedings of Canada. So I say this every time I speak because I have to make it understood that as an Iroquois nationalist, as a member of the Haudenosaunee, the great, in our language we're known as the Ginyongehogas, which is the people of the land of the Flint. That's the original name of the Mohawk. Mohawk was a negative adjective given to us by one of our adversaries back then years ago, the Algonquins. I won't say what that means at the moment, but at another time. But the point I'm making here right now is that as a keeper of the peace, you see, we always believed in the tenets of the great law and all of the articles of Confederation. All the wampums, they're called, and this wampum not meaning money, but these are wampums, these are statues, these are like amendments, these are like the constitutional amendments, the law written within the Constitution. Well, this was adopted, right, from the wampums of the Guyanagoa, the great law. So, and people would do well to study that and understand that, you see, to understand where the seats of democracy came from in this sense. So, but upholding the rule of law is what I was confronted with. You see, as an individual, I not only didn't do it just as a Mohawk nationalist, I tried to uphold the great law by way of extension of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights of the U.S. I was upholding as a human being those safeguards that were given to us in the early days of the formulating of the U.S. Constitution and Bill of Rights, those safeguards against the rise of tyranny. That included even the Second Amendment of the United States Constitution to defend oneself against the rise of tyranny. So, understanding this, in my mind, I'm trying to be, because the older you get, the more peaceful you get, and I guess in a sense, but I still have this insatiable desire to uphold the rule of law. And I've seen post 9/11 give this unbridled war on terror, which gave them the ability to just go carte blanche around the world to invade, to steal people's resources, and to justify it in the name of fighting the war on terror, whether it's the war on drugs, the war on terror, the war on this, the war on that. The fact of the matter is we've all been bamboozled by Wall Street bankers and international financiers and all of the politicians and standing armies that they command at their whims. So we have to be able to say, hey, wait a minute. We know who you are and what you're doing. This is a game plan that's going to come to an end, and we have got to stop it. Again, I was put to the juncture within my own self, saying to myself at that point, am I going to allow this continual slip into tyranny, or am I going to try to arrest this firsthand and live according to my beliefs? Now there was a fellow that wrote an article, and I don't have his name here right now, but he did a little synopsis of, he says, splitting this guy arrested for attempting a citizen's arrest on George W. Bush, and this was on March, this was in March 2009. And it says, in order to comprehend what's going on, please see the book by the legal scholar Professor Francis Boyle, Protesting Power, War, Resistance, and Law, or read it online. Francis Boyle observes in the very first chapter titled The Right to Engage Civil Resistance to Prevent State Crimes, items 15 to 16, pages 9 and 10. Now, if you can, see if you can, you people can get that book, Protesting Power, War and Resistance and Law. Now, there's a quick quote in there that he says, the judgment of the Nuremberg International Military Tribunal meted out severe punishment in 1984 against individuals who acted in full compliance of domestic law, but in disregard of the limitations of international law, had committed war crimes as defined in its Chapter 6, FRD 69-1948. That charter had been enacted as a law of the United States, 59 Statute 5144-1945. See also U.S. War Crimes Act 18 U.S.C. 2441. By implication, the Nuremberg judgment privileges all citizens of nations engaged in war crime to act in a measured but effective way to prevent the continuing commissions of those crimes. The same privilege is recognized by means of Article 38 of the Statute of the International Court of Justice. General principles of law recognized by all civilized nations which have been adopted as a treaty by the United States. In the present day, there has been a breakdown in the constitutional principles of checks and balances which implements the separations of powers. Most notably, neither Congress nor courts have been willing to ensure that the executive branch acts within the law that limits methods and means of the threat of, or use of military force. In spite of years in which these defendants have participated in citizens' petitions, letters, referendums, civil cases, requests for criminal prosecution, and the recent decisions on these questions with the full participation of the United States before the International Court of Justice, the U.S. flouts its responsibility to abide by the laws of war, laws to which we are fundamentally bound. Under these circumstances, where redress within traditional channels is refused and ineffective, domestic criminal law coincides with the Nuremberg Principle, mentioned in the preceding paragraph, to afford a justification for seeming violations of criminal laws in an effort to prevent the war of crimes outlined above. All that said, what was basically saying here is that we have to arrest that previous and potential current administrations that are violating the rule of law and who are using the war on terror to extrapolate unheard of wealth in the form of oil, in the form of gas, in the form of pipelines in the Black Seas, and also in establishing international dominance in the world by way of space wars and space defense systems that this administration is definitely pushing us towards with the by way of Zbigniew Brzezinski, who, by the way, wrote the book, The Grand Chessboard, for which gave birth the Project for a New American Centuries, or PNACs, the neoconservatives that signed on for an all-out strategy to take control of the world's resources and military strategic defenses by in the 21st century. But basically, out of that document came the infamous statement that said that in order to justify an incursion into the Mideast to gather up the much-needed resources to keep the whole U.S. industrial technological machine alive, that the U.S. would have to, the only way that the American people would be able to justify such kinds of incursions would have to be by catalyzing and catastrophic events such as that which was perpetuated in Pearl Harbor in the 1940s.
Which is exactly what happened. And
which
we know
exactly
from the
PNAC. 9/11.
Right, yes. All right, tell you what, we got to take a break, take a breath. We'll be back in 3 minutes with more. John's putting the sky bond core, folks. And when we get back, we'll talk a little bit more about 9/11. Then we're going to go into his experience at Attica, folks. So you don't want to turn that dial. Stick around. We'll be back in three. Yeah. All right, folks, we're back with the American Awakening. My special guest, John, Splitting the Sky Bancor. And before the break, we were talking about Zbigniew Brzezinski's grand chessboard and how they took that. The neocons took it. They turned it into the project for a new American century out of the, American Enterprise Institute. And in there, there was a catalyzing and catastrophic event they needed. They pulled it off. John, you and I know it, and the listening audience knows it, except if you're a brand listener and you haven't heard this before. And then they've taken the entire world, basically, and turned it upside down. They've stripped us of our rights. They're working on stripping us of our First Amendment right to free speech as we speak, because I just got a notice here just today from Ted Pike regarding the hate crimes legislation that may get passed as early as next week, maybe get voted on in the Senate, and that's already going on up in Canada, John. I'm sure you know, but they're trying to put that here and just basically silence Americans is what they're doing. So we're seeing the entire nation, the entire world get turned upside down by this, by a group of radicals. The only terrorists that I know of are the terrorists in the military-industrial complex and in the White House that have literally taken Americans and what they stand for, and Canadians and people all over the world. You know, humanity as a whole has that little kernel of freedom, that spirit of light that burns within us, and they're trying to oppress us and subdue us. John, your thoughts?
Well, I totally agree, and that's exactly why I fight with such vigor, because I will not sit back and allow tyranny, man, and total all-out policing to happen, as I have witnessed on a number of occasions, fascism, man, in motion. I've also rebelled against fascism in motion, and I have a history of doing that, I like to interject, though, here at the moment, before I go off into some of those areas that I've been involved in and struggling against the repression and fascism. And one of the things I'd like to say is that at the moment I'm sort of at a juncture, like in order to affect my case, I see that, as we say, there's a probability that they may try to throw my case out of court so that I can't proceed as well as to educate, use it as an educating tool to educate people about the need to arrest war criminals and to uphold the rule of law. But I also feel that there's also the real possibility that could try to muzzle me, just like you were saying, use the opportunity to muzzle me on some level. I won't be muzzled. I won't be imprisoned. At my choice, I'll do everything I can to stay free and to continue to do the work necessary. I believe it's not the end. No matter what happens with this court, it's not the end of this situation. It's just really just the beginning. It's the beginning of the need to excite a movement of civil resistance against those war criminals that need to be apprehended and brought to justice. So, I mean, like on May 13th, there's Condoleezza Rice is coming to speak at the University of Calgary. And so she's going to be there, and she's going to be met by a lot of people there, going to be ready to greet her. Not such a good welcoming, though. They're going to be there to arrest her as a war criminal. There's also talk of Dick Cheney coming to British Columbia for a week in October to do some fishing. He's going to be met by resistors, and resistors are going to attempt to arrest him for war crimes. So this is just the beginning of a process that we're trying to stimulate in the minds of people worldwide, the necessity to arrest these war criminals. Because if the rule of law is going to suffice, this Obama administration has got to understand that it cannot just say, we recognize that, terrible things were done and that torture was executed and it was in violation of laws. But we can't look in the past. We have to look in the future. Well, that's just pure BS. I mean, point blank, we cannot look to the future and move on when we have all this lingering war criminals still going around the world trying to extrapolate funds and acting as heroes when in reality they are cold-blooded killers and zeros. And so these people must be apprehended and brought to justice. So I guess what I'm saying, but you know, but when you try to affect movement, you gotta have people out there helping you. Now I'm to a juncture now where I had expected that certain folks might help pay for my lawyers and stuff like that, and to raise money from the people to help to pay for these lawyers. But the funds are trickling in at a very slow pace. And the lawyer's fees are always outrageous. I mean, I had a quote of something like $15,000 for just a 4-day trial, which is supposed to be this big break. And so in order, but there's no way I can pay for it. And time is moving quickly and fastly on us. So I'm wondering, I'm saying if your listeners could, send a donation, a check or money order, I could totally appreciate it. It could be sent to John Boncore, Boncore, Post Office Box 1492, Chase, Chase, BC, which is short for British Columbia, and that's VOE1MO. If somebody would like to do something anonymous and like to make a transfer, you could call me at 250-679-7743, and or you could contact me by way of email, splittingthesky@yahoo.com. So I say, so with the juncture it has brought me to this is if I can't get enough finance to pay for a lawyer, I'm going to have to just relieve the lawyer that I've hired and just tell him I can't afford him and I have to go into court and argue my own case, because I will not, you know, people say, well, the courts will appoint an attorney. Well, I don't. It's the courts that appointed me an attorney years ago got me 8 years for an attempted robbery, and what all I got was as a starving young kid in the streets of Buffalo, New York, all I ended up with was a submarine sandwich. Got me 8 years for that. And so I have a very bad taste in my mouth about state-appointed attorneys. And any way you look at it, if they're appointed by the state, they will do the bidding of the state. And in this case, they will try to any court-appointed attorney will basically try to convince me to plead guilty, take a fine, and go away and put restrictions on me against the use of trying to arrest any other war criminals. I'm saying I'm not the war criminal here. George W. Bush is the war criminal. Condoleezza Rice is the war criminal. Donald Rumsfeld is the war criminal. Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Pearl, Douglas Fife, Richard Addy. All of these people are war criminals. I did not obstruct a peace officer in the performance of his duty. I instructed him to do his duty. He was derelict in his duty, and he then obstructed me from performing a service to humanity by arresting a known torturer and a known international killer, international terrorist known as George W. Bush. Now, that's the way I see things, and that's the way I will always see them. And I will never, ever get on my knees and beg to nobody for help. I will ask in a good way for help, but people should understand that we are either allies or we're not. And if you really believe, then we've got to join our forces and help each other get to the other end of this. Because the other end of this is either we restore our rights as a people, as patriarchs, under the guarantees and the safeguards and protections of the Constitution and Bill of Rights, or we go down a slippery slope to unemployment, to mass riots in the streets, and to bailouts, man, that have basically stole the finances of the people, leaving people without homes, without being able to pay their mortgages under subprime lending scandals, and then subsequently everybody's in the streets, and there's riots all over the place, and there's roundups, and there's imprisonments and internment camps, FEMA-type internment camps, and believe me, there's some dark days ahead if we don't intervene and demand the rule of law be executed by the people according to the original tenets of the constitutions of the United States or the Bill of Charter of Rights in Canada. So that said,
John, I tell you, go ahead. I was going to say, I think I speak for myself as well as the listening audience. We're all on the same page as you. We all have the same fight. With the exception of maybe the new listeners that come on and they're a little bit skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
If they listen for any length of time, we wake them up. But you know, in light of that, I wanted to ask you, you know, you're saying that Condoleezza Rice is supposed to be coming up there and possibly Dick Cheney.
Yeah.
Are there other people up there in your group or people who have the, you know, the fortitude, the guts that you have to try and attempt to do the same thing? Because even though it doesn't work, even though, you know, they're going to get tackled, they're going to get handcuffed and arrested, we're making a statement here.
Yeah.
I mean, are you the only
exactly.
one in the crowd? Right. Are you the only one in the crowd, or are there other people that are going to step up to the plate?
I've been led to believe that there are a lot of people that that are inspired by what I did, to the point where they intend to break lines when these people come in. I will never know until we see.
No, that's true, and this is something that, that we'll wait and see how it plays out. But
yeah.
as I said before, I'm not sure about Canada, but I know down here in the States, people are getting very, very incensed about what's going on here with these bailouts and the stimulus package, and they're starting to see that all of this money that's been allotted is not going to help them. It's going to help build a government even bigger against them.
Exactly.
That being said, We've got a top of the hour break coming up. We want to take a break, get a cup of coffee or tea, John, go to the news. When we get back, I want to go into this story about Attica because I remember that very well. Several movies have been made about it. I remember protests going on at college campuses all over the country. There were songs written about it, and I want to hear your story, and so does the listening audience when we get back. So we'll be back after the news. Michael Herzog, The American Awakening, with my special guest, John Splitting the Sky Boncour. Don't change the dial, folks. Much more to come.
Live from the Valley of the Sun, sharing the news unedited, untainted, and unscreened. The real news you'll never hear on Fox, CNN, or NBC. Serious issues affecting all fellow Americans and the world. The man whose website is monitored by more feds than Osama bin Laden. The man who truly is not ready to make nice. Here's Michael Herzog with The American Awakening.
All right, folks, we're back. Third hour of The American Awakening with my special guest, John Splitting the Sky Boncour. The website is splittingthesky.net. And, you know, folks, many of you may have heard, I believe it was Monday, I had Karen Russo on my show, who has the wrongfuldeathinstitute.com. And she's an advocate for rights for prisoners, both while they are alive and after they've passed away, and all of the terrible atrocities that are being perpetrated on prisoners in our prison system. And interestingly enough, she mentioned that there are now 2.3 incarcerated people in this country, more than any other nation in the world, and 4.5 million that are on either probation or parole. And on John's website, I was perusing through earlier before I had him on, and I was looking, and he mentioned the same thing. At the time, at the Attica riots, there was only, I believe, 670,000 people, if that figure is correct, that were incarcerated. So prison is big business. And with that, John, you had mentioned just before we went to the top of the hour break that you got 8 years in prison for stealing a submarine sandwich. Did I hear you correctly?
Well, actually, I attempted a robbery out of pure desperation. I was sleeping in the streets. I was a 17-year-old kid that spent most of my life in boarding schools, like the residential schools, fighting off, man, potential sexual attacks and beatings and torture by people that ran, you know, nuns and priests that ran these places, and also people that worked there. And, of course, then I ended up in reform schools for fighting those would-be attackers off. I was out for 6 or 7 months out of the reform school, and I had no job, I had absolutely no training, I had no way of survival, no means of survival, no outlets for help in Buffalo, New York, and it was about 30 below zero, and it was just, you know, for a week I had been sleeping in hallways and park benches, and then the only way to keep warm was to get a bottle of Southern Comfort or something like that and just try to numb your way through it and, you know, and pass out. Of course, I didn't realize I probably could have killed myself doing that, but I was a pretty lost young fellow there. And So anyways, out of desperation one night, I pretended that I was going to put a finger in my pocket and just pretend like I was sticking somebody up for some cash. And, of course, the lady that was there, she yelled out, and her brothers come down, running downstairs. They were a couple of Italian guys. And they were mob-related, and but they owned this little mom-and-pop store over there. And so I tried running out. I fell down the steps, and hurt my back pretty bad. They jumped me, and then they brought me back in. And actually, they asked me why I did it, you know, because they called the cops, and the cops come to get me, Precinct 10 in Buffalo. And so anyways, I told them, well, I'm tired of sleeping in hallways and stuff, and just one of those things, right? And so they gave me a greasy Italian submarine sandwich, gave me heartburn all the way down to the precinct. But then when I went to, I was 17, going on 18, and so I was in the county jail, and they basically, they got me this lawyer, and he was pushing for a probation report, and technically it was the only thing I'd ever done in life. And so they should have let me out on probation, but when I went before the judge said that savages like you belong in the cage. And so he was a real racist, and I ended up in jail. He gave me 8 years for an attempted robbery.
And this was your first time of doing anything. They gave you 8 years. Never been in trouble before other than the reform
school. Never been in trouble before, and I got 8 years for an attempted robbery, which I got absolutely nothing out except heartburn from a greasy Italian sub.
And this is what put you in Attica?
This is what put me in the prison system. And I went to Elmira Reform School, Reformatory, which is a prison. And I went there to be indoctrinated, to be orientated. And from there, I was sent off to a prison called Coxsackie in upstate New York. At that time, I was becoming politically aware, and I was moving with people that were protesting prison conditions. And so I helped organize a strike there at Coxsackie and a work stoppage for better food and for better clothes and for better, you know, treatment and for more funds in terms of the kind of monies that we were paid for working in state-owned controlled industries.
Well, let me stop you. At that time, at that time, John,
yeah.
What were, and the reason I'm asking you these questions, because I just mentioned I had Karen Russo,
yeah.
Which is very adept in the prison system right now. At
yeah.
that time, what were they paying the prisoners in the prison system?
Yeah. Well, what they were doing is you'd work in sweatshops all day long, 6 days a week, with one shower a week, and sometimes up to 10 hours a day. Sweatshops that were very dangerous, making hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars, of profits for the businesses that were doing it in conjunction with the slave labor from the prison camps. They were paying us 2 cents a day.
2 cents a day?
Two
oh my
cents
God.
A day.
Okay, and so you went from Elmira to Coxsackie, and
yes.
At some point in time, I'm assuming, and by the way,
yes.
And one other thing I want to mention before we proceed here, when you did this attempted robbery, you were underage, you were a minor. So
yes,
how
I was.
Is it, so how is it that they could sentence you to 8 years in an adult prison for this? I don't understand.
It's a good question, and the other thing is that I should never ended up in Attica because I was still only 19, and you had to be 21 years old to be there.
Okay.
So,
all right,
anyways,
well, yeah.
So what happens? Anyways, we got vamped on by the police at Coxsackie. We've been gassed and maced, and we were beaten up severely and thrown into solitary confinement. And then they had the dogs that had bit us, German shepherds. And then they, the next day they shipped us out, put us on a bus, and they sent us to, they sent me back to Elmira, just time the prison part. And, I then, was involved in more organizing, and then they subsequently started labeling certain people militants. And there was a whole lot of resistance going on at that time. People just weren't accepting the real brutal kind of conditions in prisons. It was really hardcore authoritarian regimentation and the brutality that was exercised by the police, which were all white police officers. Many of them were avowed members of the Ku Klux Klan, neo-Nazis, and eventually when I got to Attica, we found out that the warden of Attica was in fact the head Klansman, the Grand Imperial Wizard of the local clan at Attica. So what we had is, and you had majority of the population was black, Latino, and Indian. And poor white working class was 25% of the prison population. But what you had also at the same time, it came through the anti-war movement, the women's movement, you had the rise of the black movement, the Latino movements, Black Panthers and Black Liberation Army, the Muslims. You had all these different, social resistance movements going on in the late 60s, early 70s. So what happened was there was a guy by the name of Jackson, I forget his first name, George Jackson. He was a prisoner in San Quentin, and he had written a few books, and his books were just these fiery revolutionary type books, and I read the books, and they really appealed to me at that point in my very young and angry days. And I was rebelling all of the torture and abuse that I took over the years, and I just was really, launching out against man authority left and right. But if you realize, by the time I went to Attica, I mean, they had such a regimentation that they would let you know right from the very beginning there was absolutely no talk in line. Or if you went and lined up to go to a chow, or you went to go anywhere, there was absolutely no talking. And if you were caught talking, they'd pull you right out in the line and club you to death right there. There was a number of killings that were done right. It shocked and horrified us. And the amounts, and it was known that if you were taken up to solitary confinement, they would starve you and beat you on a rotation basis. They would stick the sticks up your anus, and they would do horrible crimes against you. I mean, torture, unbelievable torture. The same torture that was being practiced in the U.S. penal systems is the same torture by this guy Miller that was exported to Abu Ghraib.
All right, let me stop you right there. We've got to take a break. We'll be back. We'll continue with this. Michael Herzog, The American Awakening, with my special guest, John, Splitting the Sky, Boncour. More to come, folks. Don't.
Toxic.
We're back with The American Awakening. My special guest, John, Splitting the Sky, Boncour, and he's been so gracious as to share this story, which I'm very, very, very interested in hearing, because I know back during the Attica riots, I was a young man, just a little bit older than John, and frankly, I wasn't real privy. I didn't know exactly what was going on in there, but I'm waiting with anticipation to hear it. And John, before the break, you were talking about even if you were going to chow and they caught you talking in line, they would pull you out and literally beat you to death right on the spot. Was this happening at prisons across the country, or was this just isolated to Attica, or do you know?
No, this was basically a general rule across country. Thousands of people were murdered, in with impunity by prison guards all over the United States. And as many suspected prisoners before they ever got to jail were killed by police. Long before they got there and just come up mysteriously, dead. So this was racist America. Very heavy racism during that period. And so anyways, what happened with this guy, this George Jackson, they said that, he had tried to, escape from San Quentin, or one of those prisons out there, and that, he had a 38 snub nose in his afro. And they shot him to death 19 times. Well, of course, this guy, again, I said he was very inspirational to many people. So on August the, now you ought to understand, I got there only 16 days before Attica jumped, before Attica went off. I was transferred from Elmira. And, this happened, you are not allowed to congregate more than three people at a time. And if you were, then you could be thrown in the box for that, any minor infraction. And you could never, ever talk back to a cop or you'd be beaten again. You'd be seriously beaten to death. Or seriously put on a critical list and wish you had been beaten to death. That's how bad, severely people were brutalized. But, there was a very strong resistance growing, and when George Jackson was murdered on August the 27th, we held, in the yard, we held a vigil where everybody came together and commemorated with a prayer and to commemorate his honor. Well, of course, that kind of started shaking the administration up. Now, a couple days later after that incident, there was a group there, the Attica Liberation Faction, trying to get redress in terms of the conditions. So they were meeting with the warrior, the warden and other prison administration's officials. But, but that was basically, there was, you know, tit for tat, and there was a new guy who was a guy by the, who was the commissioner of the U.S. prisons or New York State penal system. It was a guy by the name of Russell G. Oswald. And, he answered only to, Nelson Rockefeller, the governor at that time. What happened was on September the 8th or September the 6th, there was a scrimmage between, no, it was the 8th, there was a scrimmage between a white guy and a black guy, on a football game, and this, lieutenant by the name of Maroney came out with about 20 guards, goons, and the goon squad, and they came out, and, this lieutenant said, lock that nigger up. And, okay. Of course, well, this guy, he was a Black Panther, and he, you know, when they went to grab him, and I was lifting weights with, one of my, native buddies, a big guy named Lenny from Rochester, and as I was pushing up my couple hundred pounds off my chest, he said, holy smokes, did you see that? And what happened was, I put the weights down just in time to watch this black guy smack the lieutenant in the face a second time. Well, of course, that was totally unheard of, but at the same time, almost spontaneously, everybody in the yard circled around all the goons, and that was like, that was it, enough was enough. I was pretty angry and, well, you know, these guards and a lieutenant was very, very, they were very afraid and at that point, the lieutenant said, well, I promise you, I'll give you my Eagle Scout's honor, I won't lock these guys up. You know, and I kind of lashed out and smacked him in the face and told him, I says, the hell with your Eagle Scout honor, right? And of course, they pulled me through the crowd, and some of the guys said to me, hey, man, they're going to kill you. And, you know, at that point, it was like I just really didn't care. I didn't have much to live for. I didn't feel like anyways. I never knew if I was going to get out the joint. I had nowhere to go. And so as far as I was concerned, hey, let the chips fall wherever they fall. So in any event, what happened is everybody was locked back in the cells, and then these guards and that lieutenant were going around looking to see, you know, who the two guys they wanted to lock up, and they were looking for me, the third guy, but, it didn't, materialize. They walked past my cell and they didn't really recognize me, so I kind of moved on to the next day. And I admit it, you know what I mean? I'm not one about a lie about anything. I admit it, and I've said it publicly a number of times, you know, that this is, you know, if you're going to tell history, don't tell a falsified version. Tell what really happened. Because, you know, things get taken out of proportion for what they are, what they really are. They're seen for something that the realities are the realities. We must always report the realities as they are. And so, any event, that night, we heard that they had took those two guys out, and there was people throwing cans and stuff and setting fires with toilet paper, throwing them down over the tiers and stuff like that. And, next morning, the word went around that everybody go into the breakfast not to take any breakfast. They have a strike. To have a fast. And the only people that took breakfast that morning were the diabetics. And it was so quiet. There was complete silence, and there was no, usually it's just all this banging and clanging on the metal plates and trays and stuff. And that day, there was about 400 guards in there, and you could just hear them shaking from fear. You could hear the keys rattling in that mess hall. And so all of the different cell blocks, we all get in our lines, and we're going back. Usually we go out, the doors to the outside yards are open, you go to the yards half an hour before you go to your work assignments. Doors were all closed because they intended to lock everybody in and lock the joint down. Well, there was a couple of guys. One of the guys that was at the head of the line there that day was a guy by the name of Sam Melville. He was a known guy from the Weather Underground. He was known as the Mad Bomber. He was pretty well known during those days. He and a Black Panther guy were at the front, and this lieutenant and all his guards, a captain and all his guards coming down the hall and said, they asked him, he says, well, what happened to those guys? Why'd you lock them up? And the guy says, well, we don't know, fellas, but we'll look into it. And the one guy says, the black guy says, well, I think you're full of it. And they smacked him, knocked him down, and kicked him, and before you know it, the whole place just erupted, just like it was a spark in a prairie fire. Well, that cell block, A block, if you think of the whole prison with four quarters, and at the end of each quarter, there's gates, four gates that go about 20 feet wide from the hallways, but in order to get through to the other cell blocks, you gotta get through that, what we call Times Square, which was the middle of the cell blocks area there. So you had to go through each gate to get to the other blocks. Well, they had three guards on the inside there controlling that gate. But they refused to give the keys up, so what happened is there was about 60 of us pulling on that gate, and we kept knocking that gate or rocking that gate back and forth, and eventually, we ripped the gate right out of the wall. The brick wall come tumbling down. And the gate went down and fell down and hit an officer in the head by the name of William Quinn.
Okay, well, let's take a break right there. Now, we've got two more segments to get through this, John, and I want you to give us as much as you can in those two segments. We'll be back in three. Michael Herzog, The American Awakening, getting the story of Attica from inside the prison, folks. Be back. All right, folks, we're back with The American Awakening, and we're talking to my special guest, John Boncour, who's giving us the story of Attica right now from inside the walls because he was there. And so, John, you guys all started shaking the gate and basically ripped it right out of the brick wall. So go ahead and continue.
When the gate went down, he hit an officer by the name of William Quinn in the head, and eventually he died 2 days later. Of course, I was falsely accused of hitting this guy over the head with a stick or something and causing his death. And this is what I was charged with eventually for the alleged killing of a guard, which, of course, I to this day say that it didn't happen the way they said it happened. That it was, if anything, it was an accidental thing when the gate came down. But the reality is that his death caused... At the time, he was sent out to the hospital, but we had seized the prison and we held 50 hostages, inmates or guards, and put them in inmate clothing and held them for 5 days while we negotiated a change in the prison conditions. Many outside observers like Assemblyman Arthur O. Eve and Tom Wicker of the New York Times, Will Kunstler, the famous civil rights attorney, Senator John Dunn, all these people, many people came in from the outside to come in as observers, and we negotiated for five days, and some people weren't satisfied with negotiating for better conditions inside prisons. Other people demanded transportation to a non-imperialistic country and a flight out of there. Well, of course, at that point, there were 17 countries in the world that said that they would take those who wanted to go. But anyways, the long and short is, for 5 days, we held out in D Yard, And on the last day, we're given an ultimatum, and actually Russell J. Oswald came in and out and negotiated in good faith. The thing that we had in our favor was that for the first time, and this was because of Russell G. Oswald, but for the first time in history, they allowed the national media, CBS and NBC, ABC, all the major networks were in there, and all the major newspapers were there. So they covered live what happened at Attica, and so this gave us to put a human face on prisoners. Up until that point, nobody ever cared about anybody going into prisons. Well, anyways, on the last day, they gave us an ultimatum. And they said, Rockefeller said to retake the prison. And so on September 13th, 1971, that morning, they locked down, they kept the observers out, and they cut off the power to the prison. And they sent a helicopter up in the air, and the helicopter flew around and said, put your hands on top of your head, surrender to an officer, you will not be harmed. As it flew around, it came back around, and it dropped a big canister, almost like a oil barrel of gas, and that gas exploded on top of the catwalk and exploded and saturated the yard with CN4 gas, which was banned. It was banned for use in Vietnam as a violation of the 1906 Geneva Conventions, cruel and unusual punishment in warfare. They dropped four more of those canisters, and at that point there was 1,000 state troopers on top of the prison. Inside, it was raining that morning, and there was 1,000 state troopers in bright orange raincoats and gas masks, and every kind of weapon you could possibly think of. When the fifth canister dropped, one guard shot, and before you know it, guards had brought in their own guns from their own homes. At that moment, they began shooting, and within 10 minutes, they had let off over 50,000 rounds of bullets, and there was many, many people screaming. I witnessed many people being shot, guts spilling out, heads being blown off. I watched one guy being shot so many times by a sub-Tommy machine gun that he was shooting so many times that he stood there for 3 minutes holding the flag, and he was shot so many times he didn't fall until they stopped shooting. I watched them grab people and shove, take them, strip them naked, shove guns up their butts, pull the trigger on, disembowel them, stuff guns down their mouth. Shot him.
Okay, let me stop you for a minute, John. We've got a caller. We've got Wayne in Canada that's calling, so let's take him. Okay. Wayne in Canada, you're on with Michael and John. Go ahead.
Yeah, good afternoon, Michael, and hello, Doc. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, my brother. How you doing, Wayne?
I'm doing well. Listen, this has just been an awesome show. I want to thank Michael for having you on because you've just gotten so much information out there. But I wanted to interject, too, because I want people to know I know this man personally. I'm a friend of his, and I'm a former prison guard and a former peace officer, and I'm very honored to call this man my friend. Okay, this man is talking truth, speaking truth to power, and he is coming from it from the correct place, from the background of, or from a standpoint of justice, wanting justice, not for grandstanding, not for making money, not for trying to get photo ops and selling stuff that we know certain other people do. He's in this for the right reasons, and I'm just so proud to call him my friend and my brother. He won't do this on his own, I know, so I called him to tell you this. I put together a DVD of six different presentations he's given in the last year, and specifically because he needs to raise some money for his defense. And for anybody who can donate at least $20, you know, we'll be pleased to send them one of these DVDs. And he also has a wonderful, wonderful autobiography. It's over 650 pages. And if anybody wanted to purchase that, like, they could call him as well or email him. As I know,
do you have a banner for it? Do you guys have a banner for it? I'll put it up on my website.
I don't have a banner for it yet, but I will try and get on that this weekend, and I'll send it to you. But thank you so much again, Michael. Appreciate it.
All right. Hey, not a problem. You know, this DVD, folks, if you can afford $20 to send it, I'm sure you send it. Where would you send it? Would you send it to the website, the address that you gave early in the program, John?
I can send from here. I have copies here. Or you can go to warcriminalsout.com, and it's listed there, too.
Okay, very good. Folks, hey, that's a great value. If you could send $20, I'll give you a video. If you could send $100, you know, send $100. This guy is, well, he stood up for all of us here. And I don't want to get off topic. I want to appreciate the call coming in from Wayne. And I want you to continue with your story here. We want to make sure we get it all out before the end of the program, John. So go ahead and continue.
Yeah, I want to just shout out to my brother there, too, because he has become one of my best friends here. And the man works tirelessly for the same thing, for justice, for truth. And and they call us the odd couple, the prisoner and the former guard. But we're buddies. We are the buddies of the best type. And
they're throwing the canisters out. They're shooting guns. They're blowing people's heads out. They're doing all this stuff. There was 43
yes.
people that lost their lives, right?
Yes.
Now,
including
let me ask you,
11
let me ask
of their
you,
own that day. And everybody
and
that died, according to the pathologist report in Rochester, died as a result of gun wounds. And, of course, we didn't have guns. And what happened was they forced people after they committed this bloodbath, and they forced people to strip naked, crawl on hands and knees, and then put everybody up in a snake. They identified the so-called ringleaders. They put one guy on a table. His name was Big Black. They put him on a table. They put a football underneath his chin, and they said if that football dropped, they would kill him. But then what they did is they put a cigar between his thigh and his testicles, and he had it burning. And if he moved, they would shoot him. So he lost the use of his testicles because they burned him. They sodomized people with their guns and their batons, and they sodomized people, totally wrecking people's rectums, inability. So they brutalized people, and then they formulated that you had the local sheriffs from Buffalo, New York, and the sheriff's department, and they were lined up in the halls with glass all over the floor and water, soapy water, and stripped naked, and they forced people to run a gauntlet, and they were beating people, breaking bones, breaking kneecaps, breaking heads, breaking elbows, causing massive hernias and ruptures, and making people run over glass, cutting their feet all up. People lost toes. They hit the floors that were all soapy water, and then they slid, and they packed in people four or five to a cell.
All right, we got to take a break here. We'll be back for the final segment in three. And, John, a question I have for you, ponder it until after the break. I'm sure the listening audience wants to know, too, how did you escape death when they were shooting all those bullets? We'll be back. Final segment. Stick with us, folks.
Do you have more than $25,000 in credit card debt? Would you like to be out of debt in just 90 days using a system with proven and guaranteed results for over 15 years? Would you like to stop any mortgage foreclosure and have a written guarantee that would make most attorneys scream? Hi, I'm John Glia, the author of Winning the Collection Game and founder of Zero Debt in 90 Days. My Zero Debt Expert System has helped tens of thousands of people.
My wife was really skeptical, but she liked your written guarantees, and I'm glad we went with the program. Thanks to your system, John, we've got a fresh start and are debt-free, and it only took a few months.
And you don't need an attorney to get the benefits of my proven system. In fact, you can keep your cash. No need to negotiate with creditors or pay a percentage of your debt. Call my experts today at 800-477-9256 and ask for free information on how you can be debt-free in 90 days without making one payment to any creditor. Or visit ZeroDebtGuaranteed.com. That's 800-477-9256 or ZeroDebtGuaranteed.com.
Toxic heavy metals negatively impact our health. They're in the air we breathe, the water we drink, the food we eat, the products we use, and the objects we touch. Exposure is impossible to avoid. Heavy metals build up within the body over a period of time, causing poor health. However, with Chelarex, they can be mobilized and excreted in a safe and effective manner. Chelarex was developed based on Dr. Alan Greenberg's clinical experience with heavy metal poisoning during his 25 years of medical practice. Chelarex does not contain EDTA and is made from all natural ingredients, enhancing the body's natural mechanisms for excreting heavy metals and preventing their reabsorption. Chelarex contains antioxidants to protect the liver, kidneys, central nervous system, and immune functions, and effectively mobilizes mercury and 15 other heavy metals, including aluminum, arsenic, lead, and more. Find out what Chelarex can do for you by calling 1-800-675-4568 or visit us online at chelorex.com. That's chelarex.com today.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look. I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your two-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
Second of America Awakening with my special guest John, Splitting the Sky, Bon Cor. And John, the question I posed to you before the break: how did you escape all those bullets? Where were you?
Well, you know when they always say that there's if you really believe, there seems to be this unseen protection that kind of gets you through. Well, that happened for me that day, and I really recognized that spiritual power, because I was up on top of the catwalk, and I had come from just inside the building and ran right into a cloud of gas, and the catwalk was almost 30 feet to the, you know, to the top, and I was on top of that with others, and when I ran right into a state trooper, and he had his gun pointed right in my face, he pulled the trigger and the clip fell out. Now that just doesn't happen. Unless, it's just a really weird coincidence, or else there's some divine intervention there. But in any event, two other state troopers saw that, and you could see through the gas mask, right, their eyes just wide. But then the one grabbed his gun and smacked and hit me across the face with it. And the two other guys grabbed me and they threw me over the rail down on a handball court 30 feet below. And I almost broke my back, which is why I still have problems with my back today. So I got through all that. And of course, after the massacre, then there was all these investigations. And then, because I know we're getting short for time, so I'm going to kind of wrap this really. We're going to bring it down to a concise picture here. There were 61 of us indicted and for alleged charges out of Attica. And then there was a second grand jury that was investigating the murders that were committed by the state troopers and the guards that went in to retake the prison with their own guns from their own home. What happened, Nelson Rockefeller was facing confirmation under Gerald Ford as the Vice President of the United States. He was getting nailed on his by the Democrats at that time in those hearings on the Senate floor for his role in the retaking of Attica and the blood that was shed. He eventually, what he did was, is he tried to suppress any evidence going into that second grand jury through by way of Gerald Lefcourt to the Manhattan District Court and the Bureau of Criminal Investigation. There was a guy by the name of Malcolm Bell who was a writer for, he was one of the Attica prosecutors. He was a whistleblower that refused to participate in suppressing that evidence to a grand jury. So he wrote a 60-page document to the New York Times. The New York Times sat on that article for that 60-page report for 3 months while I was on trial, until after I got convicted on like Newsweek magazine reported. Bill Kunstler was my lawyer for the trial. Ramsey Clark was my appeal lawyer. But they said, unlike most murder trials, the trial of John Hill, which is my other name. I took my mother's last name when I went to prison, John Boncourt Hill. But the trial of John Hill was totally bereft of evidence. Eventually, I was convicted 20 years of life. I was facing the electric chair. I could have went to the electric chair, but they ruled the death penalty unconstitutional in 1973. They couldn't make it ex post facto, so I was sentenced to 20 years of life on real bogus testimony. Anyways, I did 4.5 more years in prison at the threat of being killed almost 5 more times by the guards. And that's a story that's all told in the book. But the point I want to make here is that what happened is that the succeeding governor, Kerry, ordered a commission by a former judge by the name of Bernard Shaw. And 4.5 years later, he comes down with a recommendation to close the book on Attica. And basically what he did was he granted a blanket amnesty to any state trooper and guards that had committed outright murder at Attica. And then he dismissed all the pending indictments against the other 60 Attica brothers and gave me an executive clemency, which made me eligible to go to the parole board. On strength of the governor's recommendation, I should have been released. Well, for the first time in the history of New York State, I was given 2 more years to do. And that's because the person that was facing confirmation was being threatened by Dale Volcker and the New York State Police, as well as the Police Benevolence Association right across the country, threatened to strike if I was released. Anyways, the long and short is that 2 years later, I was the only person convicted for Attica and finally released. Now, on another footnote, there was a concert at the benefit concert for the Attica Brothers at the Apollo Theater, 1973. John Lennon, I think it was 73, maybe it was 71. No, it was actually 71 after Attica. But John Lennon had dedicated, him and Yoko first sang the song Imagine at the Apollo Theater. And he dedicated it to me and the Attica Brothers. So that was the first time it was ever dedicated, Imagine. I say all that to say that today, another footnote, I'm an aspiring actor. I put my life on the line, to advocate the rule of law, to see justice done in bringing war criminals to crime. I got an aspiring career as an actor. I was in the TV series with Ann Hesch called Men in Trees. I was in another TV series called Alice, I think. I was also in a movie called Deep Water with Lucas Black. And I just currently finished, ironically, 6 months ago, a movie with Chris Christopherson and Dwight Yoakam, Lizzie Kaplan, called The Last Rites of Ransom Pride, which will be coming out within the next 3 or 4 months. I believe it's going to the Toronto Film Fest in September, and it should probably be released there relatively soon. But I got 3 big scenes there. But I say all that just to say that, I don't need to grandstand to do anything. I says I'm already on my way to an aspiring career that could be, be very beneficial. But I'm also a person, I'm an actor, lecturer, activist, author. But there's a moral imperative that I feel that if you don't live according to what you believe, if you see an injustice, I mean, I'm not going to be one of them persons, people that see people being hauled off and taken off to concentration camps and thinking that, it's not me, it's them. I'm going to do everything in my power to expose those elements that conduct this kind of atrocities in violation of human rights. And I'm the kind of person, when I see a wrong, I intervene to stop the wrong before it rolls around to me or to my family. So that's the kind of commitment that I got, and I put a lot on the line for this. And I believe that if you go with the truth will eventually come back, and you can at least
You know, you can at least look at yourself in the mirror and not hang your head down low looking at the bathroom floor. I believe in the rule of law. I believe that justice must be served, and I believe that George Bush, Dick Cheney, and company must all be apprehended and brought before a war crimes tribunal, and I don't care who thinks otherwise. I will not stop anytime I see them coming into Canada. You can believe I'll be there to arrest them. And that's all I can say, because that's how I feel. I don't know what the future is going to bring, but I do know one thing. You know, I need help, and we need help to work together and to fight together. And I believe that once we realize and get a taste of our own power and empower ourselves and realize that we are the government, that we are the political bodies, that we are the judicial and the executive bodies, and that the legislative bodies, we are the ones that put people in there to represent in the halls of Congress or Parliament to represent us. And they must represent us. They must do our bidding. We're not at their whims. We're not to be slaves or exploited by those who we empowered. So I say that to you, to your listeners, and I just say that that's just a part of who I am. And it's been good being on your show.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing 3 hours. I mean, you've led a very, very interesting, very colorful, very, in some cases, tragic life. And, I'm honored to have had you share the story from behind the scenes at Attica with me, and I'm sure my listening audience as well, John. And that being said, I will be in touch with you off the air. I want to stay updated with what's going on with you in the trial. And I'm also going to have you up on my other network to do a show. So I want to wish you the Godspeed. Stay out of trouble, my friend, and I'll be in touch with you. Thank you so much again for coming on.
Thank you, Mike, and have a good day.
You too. All right. John Splitting the Sky, Boncour. I don't know, folks, about you, but, you know, I knew about Attica. I was, at the time, 21 years old. Right at the time, there was demonstrations going on all over the country on college campuses regarding a lot of different issues. And, you know, that kind of reminds me a bit of the trip that I took up to Plainfield, New Hampshire in 2007, when I was privileged enough to sit next to Randy Weaver, and I got the story firsthand right from Randy Weaver's mouth about what really happened at Ruby Ridge. And with what John just shared with us, the listening audience today, I feel privileged to have heard that story from the person that was on the inside that saw it firsthand. All right, that's the end of the week. I want you guys to have a good weekend. Stay out of trouble. I'll be back here, same time, same station, Monday with John Taylor Gatto, Weapons of Mass Destruction. Stay out of trouble, folks. Bye for now.
I'm not sure I could. They say time heals everything, but I'm still waiting.